Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone, the first of 2016. Thank you very much for joining us. As always, I'm joined by my colleague out in the United States, JJ Duke. JJ, Happy New Year, mate. How you doing?
Yeah, Kieran, Happy New Year. Glad to be back for our first show of 2016. Hopefully, as we talked about in the last episode, that this year only can continue to build on what we've seen, the growth of the women's game.
And yeah, this will be the first one this year, of course, that we're going to be doing over Skype, as we always do. But the next edition that we do will be in person, because we will both be in Baltimore for the NWSL College Draft. So we will certainly bring an episode from that. But for this episode, we, of course, have a lot to cover off. First off, we have to discuss the retirement of Hamari Sawa. We did not discuss it in the last episode because we had so much to talk about with Abby Wambeck announcing her retirement, but Hamari Sawa, an absolute legend of the game in Japan and across the world, announced that she would no longer be kicking a ball on the field. So we're going to have a little look back at some of her highlights. We're going to have a look at some of the transfers that have taken place, mainly in England, but there have been a few in Europe and America as well. We're going to have a quick look at the W League to see what the state of play is over there. And we also will, as we mentioned, be in Baltimore for the NWSL draft next week. So it'll be worth having a quick chat with JJ about some of the prospects. We've also got a couple of interviews, one with the returning Andy Spence, who has returned to his position at Everton Ladies as the manager of the club. And as I mentioned in the last episode of 2015, we have an interview, an interesting interview, with Stacey Copeland, who once was a member of the Doncaster Rovers Belles. Now she is plying her trade as a semi-professional boxer. So I had a chat with her to see how her skills from the football field have transferred into the boxing ring. But without further ado, after this short break, we will get cracking.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSO Zone.
So first off, as already mentioned in our introduction, JJ, the retirement of Hamari Sawa. If it wasn't bad enough that we had to put up with the retirement of so many legends, just before the end of the year, it was announced that Japan legend Sawa would no longer be taking to the field. What a legend we've lost.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we discussed the last show, and I think it's almost a little bit, you know, fair justice that we spent one show discussing Abby Wambeck and one separate show talking about Hamari Sawa, who is, as you said, a legend in the game. I mean, what, 25 years she's been involved with professional soccer? That's, I mean, just to put it in blatant terms, that's a quarter of a century. That is a long time to be playing at the highest level. 6 World Cups, a score of many great goals, and obviously, you know, that moment in 2011 lifting the trophy at the World Cup. I mean, this is a player that, you know, will go decades gone by and will still be remembering some of the great things that she brought, not only to the game in Japan, but to the game in the world.
I think you're right. I think, and also, the influence he had on the world game was obviously significant, but I think more so in Asia. I think when we look at that World Cup that you mentioned in 2011, Japan, they'd been in previous tournaments, but never really pulled up any trees. They'd always had decent tournaments, but they'd never really got to what you'd call the latter stages. But the fact that they were able to not only get to a latter stage, but to win the whole competition, there was so much emotion that surrounded that win as well, with the tsunami that had taken place not long before that World Cup. Sawa, along with players like Aya Miyama and Shinobu Ono and many others that were in that squad, they stepped up to the plate, but she was the one that really led those troops, wasn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a catalyst in the midfield throughout that tournament. I mean, it's just the work ethic. I mean, I think some people take that for granted with players at the top level, but you know, you're always going to expect, you know, the number 10 in blue to be going up and down the field. You know, is a player that will score the big goal, and you know, funny enough, is it a little bit kind of, I don't even know to find the right word here, but you know, Abby Wambach goes out in her last game, doesn't score a goal, but still is obviously the world's, you know, leading goal scorer at the international level. But Hamari Sawa got that, send off that every player wants, to retire at the top, winning a trophy and scoring her last goal in that match.
Yeah, and the match you're referring to is with her club team, Ajnak Kobe. It was in the final of the Impress Cup, I believe it was. And, to go out with a goal in a major tournament, well, in a final of a cup competition, to do it at the highest level, at club level, once again shows, what a star she was and what a professional she was. I mean, we are talking about, you mentioned that work ethic. Is there a player that you can think of our generation who has or had that combination of work ethic, but also an unbelievable technical ability?
I think it's a challenging question, because you look at a player like Sawa in her time, she was a trailblazer and then continued to carry on, doing what she did all throughout this different generations and era of growth in the women's game. I mean, you look at, she started playing in, I think it was early 1990 or 91, and then she's still going at 2015. I mean, that's, I don't think there is actually an answer to that question. That's just purely out of the respect to her, because, we always talk about, and no matter the sport, there's always adaptations that you have to do. There's little nuances to sport that change over time. She is able to do that and still be successful every time that there is a new change. I mean, remember in the 90s, goalkeepers couldn't move whenever they had the ball. They had to take a couple steps before releasing. At times of games, weren't played the full 90 minutes, or different, little changes here and there, but she was still able to adapt as the game got on. It became more, faster, more physical. And she was still able to continue doing what she did. And I think it might be a work ethic that you can't compare.
And of course, what we haven't mentioned is that after that World Cup win, she was also the honourable recipient of a FIFA Ballon d'Or as well, in a time where Marta had dominated that trophy for so long. I just remember her turning up in her kimono. I think it's a kimono, wasn't it? And she just looked, class act on the field, class act off the field, very, very graceful in receiving her award. And I think that, if nothing else, really summed up Hamari Sawa, not just as a player, but as a person as well.
Yeah, and it's always, or at least for me, the one thing that sticks out. I remember, obviously, from being in the U.S., we've heard all the stories that came in the aftermath of the 2011 World Cup, and I know Hope Solo has went on record and saying that Sawa wasn't a person that didn't even want to celebrate winning that trophy on the field, because obviously it was a great match, but just the humility that she has, it's something that I think should be revered, and something that maybe a few players in this generation should look a little more towards to. Obviously, we have in this game, this is just in sport in general, where ego sometimes takes over. But, you look at someone, as you said, with the grace that she has of how she's gone about her business, both on and off the field. That's something that should be, taught to for generations to come.
Yeah, and what's interesting is, obviously, she announced her retirement from international football, didn't she, in August 2012, after helping Japan win a silver medal at the London 2012 Olympics. Obviously, the United States got their revenge at Wembley Stadium. But her influence is without question, because she was, I'm going to assume, convinced to come back. And the fact that she was able to play in the 2015 World Cup at the age of 36, 37, whatever she is now, showed exactly how much she was valued, not just by the management team, but also must have been by the players around her, and not just her influence on the field, but off of it as well.
And I think also it shows a testament to that, if you step away, and this is only on assumption because I've never played soccer nearly that level that these players have been at, but to step away from that game, from the game at that level, and say, okay, mentally you might be done, but then all of a sudden, a couple of years later, to go have that hunger to get yourself back to that level to even be in consideration. I mean, that's something to speak to itself. I remember it, back in mid-2014, you know, there were some murmurs that were going around for Mexican team that the great Maribel Dominguez was thinking about coming back and trying to make an effort to get back onto that Mexico team that got to the World Cup. That was a player kind of almost in the comparison for the fact that she was a legend in the Mexican game to Sawa was in the Japanese game, that, you know, Dominguez was the player that kind of transitioned and gave, you know, women's football a little bit of hope in Mexico. And, you know, she wasn't able to get ready in time for that tournament, at least, you know, to have an impact. And, you know, Sawa is still, you know, coming in, granted, maybe not in a starting role all the time, but still coming in and having an impact on how a game would go about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a player that was admired the world over, I've never heard a bad word said about Sawa. And to be honest, I've never really heard a bad word said about a lot of the Japanese team. Very, very gracious. I remember at the 2012 Olympics, I think it was, when Japan defeated France. There's quite an iconic image there of, I think it's Miyama consoling Camille Abelie. I think the two of them may have played together in the United States during the WPS. And that's Japan all over. And I think that's Hamari Sawa all over when you look at the way that she acted on the field. And she will be missed, without a doubt, in a year where we saw so many retirements. Abby Wambeck and players like that will grab headlines because we're more exposed to the US women's national team in terms of media coverage and television coverage. But Hamari Sawa's influence on the game is no less important when you think about the impact that it's had in Asia, the impact it's had on Japan and winning that World Cup. And for me, when you look at her achievements, Ballon d'Or winner, World Cup winner, Olympic silver medalist, she'll go down as one of the greats, won't she?
Oh, I agree with that. And, you know, everything that you said in the last minute or so, I'm backing you all the way because, you know, these are players that are going to go down in history as the best. And if you want to strive to be the best, you look at players, you know, like Sawa, like a Wambach, and you work that hard. And, you know, and it's funny, of course, because Abby Wambach, her slogan when she was playing her last game was "Make them forget me." Well, I'm sorry, Ms. Wambach, I'm going to have to disagree with you there. You're going to have to look at a player like that to want to be at that level. And I think, you know, as we've seen these two players step away from the game that we love, I think, you know, hopefully that there is going to be somewhere down the road for the U.S. another Abby Wambach, you know, lying in the wings, another Hamari Sawa waiting to come on to the stage. And, you know, hopefully we see it sooner rather than later. But, you know, again, this is, it's a sad time, obviously, for us, you know, seeing these players depart. But we also have to obviously celebrate, you know, what they have done for the game and, you know, look at it at that way as well.
Absolutely. I think all I can say to Hamari Sawa is arigato. Thank you very much for what you gave to the game. Thank you very much to Abby Wambeck for what she gave to the game and all the other players that retired last year. 2015 was the year that we saw a lot of high-profile players leave the field for the very last time. And I think we'll wrap it up there, mate. And we will come back after a short break and talk about some of the transfers that have taken place in various parts of the world after this.
Women's Soccer Zone would like to thank our partners, She Kicks Magazine. Subscribe at shekicks.net for even more women's football.
So welcome back, JJ. There has been a few transfers that have taken place in various leagues, various countries, none more than over here in England, with some high-profile moves taking place. I don't know if you've been keeping track of what's been going on, mate, but I think probably two stand out as it stands. Karen Carney, England international, Birmingham girl, born and bred, very influential for her hometown club, has made the move to Chelsea Ladies, English champions, English FA Cup winners, UEFA Women's Champions League qualifiers for next year. She has made the move to another club that plays in blue. And Farrah Williams, on the day that we're recording, one of the worst kept secrets amongst media over here in England, She's left Liverpool Ladies and has moved to Arsenal Ladies. From an American perspective and from an outsider, what do you make of those two moves?
Well, for first Karen Carney, I mean, you know, you have to give her a whole lot of credit because she stayed with a club that, you know, Birmingham City Ladies, you wouldn't really think of them as a team that'd be lifting a trophy anytime soon, at least a league level. Sure, they might have a go at it with the cup, but, you know, that's going to be a move for her professionally that's going to surround her with top-level athletes. I mean, again, this is with the greatest of respect to Birmingham City, but Chelsea is a name that's getting into the Champions League now. They've won the league. They've got one of the deepest rosters in the WSL, and I think that's going to be a great move for her. On the other side, for Farrah Williams joining Arsenal, I mean, it's really also no secret that Arsenal didn't have the season that they would like. I mean, this is a team that's, you know, synonymous with winning and with winning trophies and with winning the league. You finished third position, 5 points behind Chelsea. That's, you don't want to deem it a failure, but at the same time, you can't deem it a success. So, you know, they need players to come in and help them compete with the likes of Chelsea and Manchester City. And I think that's going to be something that Farrah Williams will bring to the table.
Yeah, I mean, Farrah was recently recognised by the Queen as well, mate. I don't know how much you guys follow the Queen's New Year's Honours list over here, but Farrah Williams and Steph Horton were both made members of the British Empire, being awarded MBEs, following in the footsteps of other players such as Casey Stoney and Kelly Smith, who've also been awarded similar accolades. So congratulations to both of them. And I think it indicates exactly the influence that Farrah's had on English football over the years and the influence that she will have on Arsenal Ladies as well. I think Pedro Losa's looking to try and add a bit of experience to that midfield. They had problems with midfield last year in terms of injuries. Vicky Lasada missed games last year. Leah Williamson missed games last year. But Farrah will add experience, she'll add quality. She'll be a great mentor for some of those young players that are coming through at Arsenal, like Leah. I tweeted out today that you know, someone that we've had on the show a few times, Leah Williamson, a very similar type of player to Farrah Williams, and who better to learn from than England's record appearance maker thus far, and still many more to come. That for me is a big move for Arsenal. Equally, Chelsea getting hold of Karen Carney. I'm a big fan of Kaz. You know, can play left, she can play right, she can play through the middle. You say about trophies, mate, Karen actually won the FA Cup in 2012 with Birmingham City. They beat Chelsea, actually beat Chelsea Ladies in the final at Bristol's Ashton Gate in 2012 on penalties. So she has got a trophy with Birmingham. Birmingham have been competitive in the Women's Super League since it started, other than the season just gone, where they probably fell a little bit shorter than they would have liked. That is probably down to the fact that teams around them are starting to go professional, are starting to train more. Birmingham are playing catch-up. And unfortunately, Kaz has probably got to a point where she's thinking, you know what, if I want to be winning trophies, as you said, if I want to be competing at the highest level, I need to be playing for one of those teams. And she's joined the best, you know, the league champions, the FA Cup champions. You know, you can't really blame her for going there, but massive loss for Birmingham as well. I know David Parker will be bitterly disappointed, but that's how it goes, unfortunately. That is the way the league is going. And looking at some of the other moves around the league, you know, you've got Manchester City are starting to strengthen as well. They've signed Scottish international Jane Ross. She will add a lot of depth. They signed Marie Hourihan from Chelsea Ladies as a backup goalkeeper to Karen Bardsley. You know, Liverpool, who have been absolutely ripped apart with some of the players that have left the club in the last few months. Tash Dowie has gone to Doncaster Rovers Bells. Farrah Williams, we've already mentioned, has gone to Arsenal Ladies. So they've had to recruit as well, and they've done so in the form of Sophie Ingle, the Wales captain. They've signed from Bristol Academy. Laura Coombs they've picked up on loan from Chelsea Ladies. And one that probably surprised a few people, but is a massive boost for Liverpool, was the capture of England keeper Siobhan Chamberlain, who, in my view, has probably been underused and undervalued in the last couple of years. She made the move down to Arsenal, looking to offer competition to Emma Byrne. Didn't really get the opportunities that she would have liked. Arsenal then signed Suri van Veenendaal, the Dutch goalkeeper. That pushed Siobhan down to third choice. She went to Notts County Ladies on loan. Didn't get a lot of game time there, playing back up to Carly Telford. She will get game time now because of Libby Stout's move to Boston Breakers. And Siobhan needs time between the sticks. She needs to get those minutes under her belt so that she can be competitive again and add competition to Karen Bardsley for the England spot. Because for me, since WSL started, and probably in the first few years that the league was going, Siobhan was the standout goalkeeper. And unfortunately, the move to Arsenal and the move to Notts County hasn't worked out, or didn't work out as she would have liked. But now she's got that opportunity to really show what she's made of and to show that she's still a top-class goalkeeper.
No, and I think she has to make that move. I mean, you look at, you know, throughout the game, there are players that are in that situation that, you know, sometimes in specific leagues you have goalkeepers of top quality from international play that, you know, they're not just your one, but your one and your two, and sometimes even in Siobhan's case, your one, two, or three goalkeepers. And you know, you have to get first team football. If you don't get first team football, then you're not going to be playing at the international level, or if you do, you're just going to be at the same position. You know, there, you can't simulate game time without having game time. You know, practice is one thing, so you know, hopefully where she is right now, as you said, was a standout at the beginning of the Women's Super League, but now has kind of fallen, not to say off the radar, but not getting games, and now she has to get games. And hopefully this is a good signing for Liverpool, who had, as you said, kind of a, in past episodes, a near disastrous season, just barely staying up in the league. Now maybe with, you know, a fresh team, a fresh mindset, might be an opportunity for her to maybe get back at a few teams a little bit who didn't give her a good look. And sometimes you want players not necessarily to have chips on their shoulders, but something to prove. And hopefully for Liverpool, this is one of them.
Yeah, top class keeper, Siobhan. Really hope it works out there for her. One player I forgot to mention that Arsenal signed is Ireland's young star, Kate McCabe. Anyone that's seen the Ireland women national team or watched the Irish Women's League over the last year or two, they will have seen a lot of Kate McCabe. And she is a real star in the making, and Arsenal have done really well to sign her from the Irish League. And I'm certain that she will add quality to that squad. Might take her a little bit of time to adapt. She's not necessarily going to walk into that team because there's a lot of quality in that Arsenal side. But Kate has been compared to Ryan Giggs in some media articles that I've seen. So it'll be interesting to see how she steps up to the plate. But definitely one to look out for when the league commences in March. I mentioned Doncaster Rovers Belles and Tash Dowie leaving Liverpool. They are certainly a team that are going to look to try and make an impact. We know that they got promoted from WSL2. We know that they are going to be going professional and that their facilities are going to be much improved than what they've been used to. And they're trying to get the players to back that up, as well as Tash Dowie. They've re-signed Jess Sigsworth, who is a young English player who went to Notts County Ladies, didn't get the opportunities that she would have liked, but is certainly a raw talent and will certainly add quality to the team. And they've added experience in the shape of Becky Easton, still going very strong after a long career and various clubs over the time playing in the women's game. And they've signed Katrin Omersdottir from Liverpool Ladies as well, Icelandic international, who will add quality to their midfield. So they are making strides as well. They are certainly not looking to be that team that goes straight back down. They will look to be competitive, and I'm sure that other clubs will follow suit as and when the right players come around. Now, I'm going to move on shortly, JJ, to transfers that have happened in Europe. But as well as players moving clubs, there have been managers moving as well. And one manager who decided to return to his previous role was Andy Spence. Now, Andy's a good friend of the show. He's been on the podcast many a time as a presenter and as a guest. I wanted to find out why he decided to come back, what was behind his decision, and what his hopes are for Everton, because obviously the last time that he was managing them was in the WSL2. They're still in WSL2, so how is he going to get them back up to WSL1? Here he is having a quick chat with me. So So Andy Spence, hat-trick appearance on Women's Soccer Zone, been a presenter on here a couple of times as well with Hamish, who is unfortunately no longer with me. But, mate, good to have you back. How you been? Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year, Kieran. Obviously, I'm delighted to make my hat-trick appearance. It's just a shame, you know, on some shows, shall we say, I won't mention them, you know, to embarrass you, but they normally give you, like, a match, you know, a match ball or something. So if you want to send that up in the post to me, clearly that'll be great.
We will do something like that. No problem. We'll get like a mini football in the post here, mate. No problem. I'll even autograph it for you.
I was going to say, actually, if you did, that would certainly halve the value of it. So that'd be great.
It was announced at the back end of 2015 that you've returned to Everton Ladies about 6 months after initially deciding to step down from your position. We won't talk about stepping down because that was covered at the time, but what was your reasoning and thinking behind coming back so soon after leaving the club back in the summer?
Yeah, obviously, you know, from my point of view, it was an opportunity that come up. You know, I'm absolutely being honest, I wasn't really expecting it because obviously, you know, Nick had gone in as the interim manager and, you know, in the second half of the season, the team done, you know, relatively well, and you know, and obviously I was expecting, probably like most people from the outside, that, you know, that Nick would continue in the role, but for her reason, she didn't feel like it was the thing that she wanted to do at that time. So obviously the club then had the conversation with me and were asking obviously where I was up to. You know, I'd been back in with the Centre of Excellence and overseeing that programme. Like, I've always had that big involvement, as you know. And, you know, the sort of 6 months had been first time, actually, that I'd probably been out of senior football in about 12 years. So it given me really an opportunity to step back and reflect for myself, for probably a process that now that I've been through it, I need to do more often. And don't worry, that doesn't mean I'm going to step aside every couple of years and have 6 months off. It just means that, you know, that reflection process as a coach and a manager is equally as important as it is for the player. So having that chance to do that has been brilliant, and that's allowed me to kind of really focus my attentions towards, you know, what would I do differently this time round. And already I feel, you know, we've started to make some real good inroads into how we're going to do things going forward with the players. Obviously, a lot of that is in-house things that, you know, are important to us as our team and our Everton team. But, you know, we've spoken a lot about getting back to our Everton values, and that's going to be really crucial to us going forward, because I'd say the part of that reflection process for myself was, well, what made Everton unique as a club, and what was it that I walked into 10, 12 years ago that I felt was always special about Everton? And I'm hoping already, on the basis of what I've seen in the first couple of weeks of pre-season, those messages that we've, you know, collectively, and it's not Andy Spence driving that, it's not my staff driving that, it's a real collective unit of all wanting to buy into something that we know, if we do right and we do consistently well, that will give us, you know, a real good opportunity to have a really positive season.
Did you feel that it was almost quite a big benefit, those 6 months, almost being an outsider looking in? You were able to not only observe what was going on at Everton, but maybe at the WSL as a whole, maybe explore other teams, other leagues as well. I guess when you're a manager, you are primarily focused on your team and your team alone, whereas you have that time away. As you said, the first time in 10, 12 years you've not been involved in senior football, it gives you that opportunity maybe to have a look further afield and explore other clubs and other leagues and other things that are going on in the women's game.
Yeah, absolutely, Keenan. You know, you've hit the nail on the head there in terms of it does give you that chance to step back. And absolutely, you know, each week, even though I wasn't obviously actively involved in on the sideline, I was still going to watch, you know, pretty much every Everton game that was at home. And I got round a number of clubs up and down the country, really, as you say, almost as an opportunity to really see what is WSL2 about, because obviously last season was our first year in there as a club. And again, the differences between WSL1 and WSL2, there are differences, of course, and it was almost, well, as you say, what can I learn and what can I understand about the league stepping away and not being in the middle of things, in the thick of the action. And that has been really crucial to me because I pretty much got to see every WSL2 team again, but this time I wasn't an opposition manager or coach. I was just an observer, and you're absolutely right. That gives you a different outlook on things, and you can really drill down on what is it that the league's about. And importantly to myself as well is, you know, what's the next level about as well? Because as we all know, the WSL1 is again, you know, continued to grow over the last 12 months. So, you know, ambitions and hopes for, you know, future, well, we want to know what that looks like. And then, of course, it would be totally remiss of me not to mention the Women's World Cup. Then that gave me a lot of time to watch a lot of football, which I enjoy doing. And as you say, probably being out of the, I suppose, the day-to-day stuff was a real opportunity to do that. So, yeah, it's an evolving and a learning process, watching football and understanding what the game's telling you and what you're seeing, and also what you'd like to add to what I do as a coach and how I would work with our players. But that was a real good process.
So how do you, looking forward, you've taken on the role again at Everton Ladies, how do you move the club forward? How do you try and challenge for those promotion places? You've got Bristol, well, what will now be known as Bristol City Women, have come down from WSL1. You're going to be competing with the likes of them. Yeovil Ladies were very strong last year. How do you move Everton forward? The first spell that you had was a difficult one because you lost a lot of experienced players. You had suffered relegation. You've lost a couple more. Paige Williams has obviously gone over to Italy to play for Brescia. How do you now move that team forward? What are you trying to do differently than maybe you had that you did differently first time round?
I think the biggest difference, Kieran, is, as I say, really drilling down. You know, it's not always on the pitch things in terms of initially with a team. And as I say, I can only be complimentary of what I saw with obviously England's national squad. You know, the reason I think a large reason behind, you know, obviously a lot of talented players and a lot of good work by the staff there. But you know what? A lot of it was about what they built away from the pitch to allow them to then perform on the pitch. So that was a big thing for me is, as I say, around these Everton values. Well, what is it that makes Everton unique? What is it that can get us in a place where every player, every staff member really, really understands what it is to be part of Everton? Because as a football club as a whole, you know, I can only never speak highly enough of what Everton is as a football club. And that really resonates right the way through any of our teams. So it doesn't matter boys or girls or, you know, senior teams, male or female, it really does come right through the club. And so I'm like, well, let's really get, or me firstly as a member of staff and as the coach and the manager, to really identify what is it that we makes us unique, and then obviously start to present that to the players. And as I say, those values are crucial. And then if we get those in place, then from our point of view, I know I've got a talented squad. I know we've got a lot of talented young players, as everyone knows. Predominantly, that has been the case for the last two or three years. But those young players now are starting to, you know, yeah, they're always going to be young over the next couple of years in terms of their footballing careers. But they're starting to get a bit of experience. They're starting to understand what top-flight football looks like. And they understand, importantly and crucially, I suppose, what WSL2 is. And that's the key thing. We're not going into this season blind in terms of what we should expect. Yes, you're right, there's going to be some, you know, real good competition again within the league. But kind of our focus is very much on, well, what can we bring to the table each week that represents Everton really well? And, you know, our fans who turn up and are really loyal, I want them to identify with that. And they're going to have a big role to play in that for us, because they're going to tell us what they want to see in an Everton team as well. And, you know, and that excites me, because I want to see an Everton team, and I want to be part of that Everton team where we do really represent the football club as a whole really well. But, you know, individually and collectively, we really move ourselves forward, because we've certainly got the potential to do that.
You've named Lindsay Johnson amongst your coaching staff after she announced her retirement at the end of WSL2 season last year. Are you looking at her as being your kind of Gary Neville figure that has that link between the players and the management?
Well, she's got an iPad, so that's a start. Yeah, no, Lindsay's obviously, you know, again, if you're talking to someone who represents Everton, who gets Everton, who's been at Everton for such a long time, that's Lindsay in a nutshell. So it was important that, A, you don't lose someone with so much experience. If we're all being honest, Lindsay was probably one of our better players over the course of the season. And so to have someone around the team, you know, for those younger players still to look up to, because, again, if you speak to the players within the squad, you know, Jono was the mother figure, I suppose, in terms of going to for advice on the pitch, advice off the pitch. So I was absolutely determined we weren't going to lose out on that experience. And Lindsay understands the game. She's obviously well respected amongst our players here at Everton, but also within the game. So again, I'm seeing Lindsay as someone who can really have a great impact on the players, on the football club, and for her own personal developments. You know, she's a full-time teacher, but, you know, who knows long-term, you know, again, why aren't the likes of Lindsay Johnson becoming, you know, managers within the WSL in the future? I've already told her she's going to take my job. And you know, and I want her to do that in the years to come, because that will be a great progression for Lindsay. So, you know, that's the type of person we want, as I say, first and foremost, who will really represent what we do well and make sure that the players understand Everton and what we do.
You mentioned young players. We mentioned that a number of youngsters have committed themselves to the clubs this week. Jenna Deere has come in from Chelsea Ladies and England Under-19 International. Are you looking to try and add a little bit of experience? You mentioned Jono, Rachel Brown-Finnis retired a year before last as well. You've lost a few experienced head over the last sort of 18 to 24 months. Are you going to try and bring any in that can kind of complement those youngsters and nurture those youngsters?
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. It goes without saying, we are a young squad. I think the thing with, obviously, experienced players and those players who probably hit that category of, you know, maybe 26 plus, those players at the moment, the vast majority who will come in and have an impact in Everton's team are probably playing in WSL1. So I'm realistic enough to know that it's going to be, you know, probably a big ask to ask a 26, 27-year-old established player to come down a division. Within the division itself, well, all the other teams will probably want to keep their established players, and rightly so. So from that point of view, the recruitment of that age band is quite difficult, I would say, just because of, A, they'd have to be coming into Everton and being good enough and capable enough of performing at the level we would want. And as I say, it's the availability of those players, because most of that age group clearly, if they can, want to be playing WSL 1 football. And as I say, those who aren't playing WSL 1 are tied into WSL 2 teams and established within their own club. So it is something, obviously, we're aware of. But again, I do get some reassurance that we have got the likes of Kelly and Vicky, the twins, who won't probably thank me for saying it, but they're now all their players in the squad. And you know, Michelle Hinnigan, you know, although she's only mid-20s, she's one of our older players. So I think it's time for those players to take even more responsibility. And again, if you look at the makeup of our younger players, you know, I'm thinking of someone like Ellie Stewart. Ellie's been a captain all the way through her career in terms of so far as a youth player. So although Ellie might only be a teenager in terms of age, in terms of experience internationally and club level, and who she is as a person, well, she should be a real good leader for our team as well. So it kind of reassures me from that point of view. We've got good young players, we've got good experience. You think of Gabby George, she's played now, this will be her third season in women's football, so she'll know this level of football and what's expected. We've got Danielle Turner, who's, you know, a fantastic player who we were delighted is staying with us, because Dan's, for me, is more than capable and will play WSL 1 football, but we want that to be with Everton. And then obviously you've mentioned our newest arrival in terms of Jenna. Well, I saw her play against, you know, Watford when Watford played us last season. She was the best player on the pitch for certainly Watford at that time. And if I'm being absolutely honest, when they played against us, she stood out against our midfield. So that gives me a real sort of good hope that adding someone like Jenna to our squad will then just add to the quality we've got in there, because I'm looking at our midfield unit now and it's so many good options for us and so many different combinations we can put together, then that's going to be a crucial area of the pitch anyway. But now we've really got a good strength and depth, and we've got so much in a nice mix of players, then it's going to be exciting to see our midfield play next year and really link the team forward and going backwards, because it's such a strong area of the pitch now.
Well, we wish you well, Andy. I'm sure that people are very much chomping at the bit for the WSL2 to start. We've got a couple of months to wait, but I know pre-season is already underway in the winter months, so not the nice summer months that we were used to from the old format when the Women's National Premier League was going. But yeah, thanks very much for coming on, mate. Always a pleasure, and best of luck for the 2016 season.
Thanks, Kieran. All the best.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSO Zone.
Okay, welcome back. That was Andy Spence. Many thanks to him for his time. Always a pleasure to have him on the show. JJ, as I mentioned, some transfers have happened in Europe and also in America. Well, I say transfers in Europe, it's more quite a headline story, I guess, in France, in that Lindsay Horan and Kosovare Aslani both had their contracts mutually cancelled by Paris Saint-Germain. Now, Horan isn't a surprise, because we are expecting her to be announced for the Portland Thorns any time now. But Aslani, as someone who has been a first-team regular for PSG over the last few years, did that one come as a surprise to you, or did you kind of expect that one?
Well, it's a surprise that it happens, I think, you know, at the same time as Horan leaving. But I think it's been, and you and I have alluded to this throughout the time that we've been able to work on the show with you, that we've seen France in their league really step away from what was a two-headed monster with Lyon and PSG, now to just Lyon. And, you know, at a time where PSG, they can't get good competition until when they get to Lyon, and when the time comes, they just don't have the firepower that the French champions do. So, you know, and also my understanding is those two are pretty good off the field as well as on the field in terms of friendship and relationships. So, you know, with that being said, and we've seen it before in all sports, when one go, they all start to follow. And I have a feeling, and again, you and I have talked about this before, it might be that PSG is starting to see some of their players that have been around, especially through the transition of trying to make this club from what it was to what it is, you know, to be a competitor in the European as well as the French game. You know, maybe they've seen the ceiling and the writing could be on the wall. You know, again, to answer your question, it is a bit of a shock, but at the same time, if we're going to be seeing these moves happen, it might as well be. But I think the real question is, where is she going to go? Because we're reading right now that, you know, it doesn't look like Sweden's going to be likely returning back to her home nation. Would it be Germany, where a lot of players are going, or could it be to the U.S.? One is questioning. That's all I could really say on that.
Well, I mean, the question could be, could she follow Horan to Portland? We're expecting, as we've said on many an occasion, for Portland to announce Lindsay at some point. So Caitlin Murray, a freelance journalist in the US, has tweeted out today that sources have told her that Portland Thorns have put a claim to Amandine Henry's discovery rights. Now, what that means is that if Amandine Henry decides to leave Lyon and she decides to go to the United States, then Portland Thorns have first pick essentially on her. Now, that's an international spot that Amandine would take if the Portland Thorns do indeed sign her. They've obviously got Dagny Brigno's daughter, they've got Jodie Taylor, they've lost Steph Catley to the Orlando Pride, Claire Polkinghorne, we're not too sure. Is there even space for someone like Kosovare Aslani? And if not, who else would benefit from a player like her in America, I guess?
You know, that's a really good question, because she is a rare talent. She's very skilled, very technical, and there are a lot of teams out there that can use her. Now, we do have to remember that she did play before in America with the Chicago Red Stars back in the days of WPS. Now, would that be a link? Who knows? That team does have international spots available. But I know, you know, speaking firsthand with Rory Dames, that he's more of a guy, in great respect to the international players, he knows more and goes through the U.S. system. So, you know, you can almost kind of rule that out. I mean, you look at some of the team, you know, teams that are, you can at least cross off the list right now. Seattle Reign, probably not going to happen, because they just have a team that's already loaded with international players, and we don't think that they have space. We've already ruled off Portland. So now we go down the middle of the U.S. Maybe FC Kansas City, perhaps. I don't know. East Coast, could be the Washington Spirit, perhaps. Big question on Sky Blue, because we don't really know what's going on over there, and I think we'll discuss that later on. Boston perhaps might have a spot or two, but it is really a question on who's got the international spots and who is willing to take a player like Aslani, and also with the reminder that they also may be going, you know, to the Olympics as well. So if you do bring her in, you're not even sure if you're going to have her for a full season.
Good point. Good point. And I agree with you on the teams that you've mentioned there. Not sure Seattle will go for Kosovari. They do have an international spot, from what I remember. But there are certainly teams out there that have more slots available. So maybe it might be something that she's interested in. Otherwise, there's plenty of clubs in Germany. Maybe even a club in England would look at her as a marquee signing. You know, maybe in Manchester City. They like big names. They haven't ventured into the transfer market too much as yet. We mentioned Jane Ross and Marie Hurahan. Maybe Kosovari Aslani is someone that they're looking at, but you never know. But some transfers that have gone through in the United States, JJ, Chiomaru Magagu, formerly of Arsenal Ladies, has now been confirmed at the Houston Dash. Katie Stengel, who, much like Christy Mewis, has left Bayern Munich and has signed for the Washington Spirit. Any others that are missing that you can think of off the top of your head?
Yeah, we do have one. Western New York Flash making the announcement that South Korean midfielder John Ga-ul, if I butchered that pronunciation, my sincere apologies, but first South Korean-born player to play in the NWSL and had a very strong World Cup, so that should be an interesting signing.
And they've bigged that one up, haven't they? They've made a big deal about that one, the Western New York Flash, so they're clearly very excited about that deal.
They are. Also, we did hear Adriana Franch is now back in the U.S., and she's going to be playing for Portland Thorns, so that's going to be a nice goalkeeper's battle between her and Michelle Batos. That looks to be about it in terms of at least very recent NWSL signings.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a few since we did our last show, and obviously we didn't mention everything because we had so much to cover. I know Antonia Goranson has obviously gone to the Seattle Reign as well. That one was announced probably about 6 weeks ago, which followed on from Manon Mellis, the Dutch international. But yeah, you're right, there's lots of movement that's bound to take place over the coming weeks and months as the season draws nearer. Pre-season is not far away, so I'm sure teams will be assessing what they have, and of course there will be the magical NWSL draft, which sometimes sees players move around as well. Portland Thorns last year, they were the team that made the most interesting trade during that draft, if I remember rightly, that involved Jodie Taylor and Jessica McDonald. Now, we'll talk about the draft shortly, but I think that's enough on transfers, and when we come back we'll have a quick look at what's going on in the W League down in Australia.
Women's Soccer Zone. It's all about the players.
So welcome back, JJ. W League in Australia, getting to the business end of the season as we approach the end of season playoffs. Melbourne City, unsurprisingly, as we record 11 wins from 11, they have qualified for the playoffs. Canberra United in second place, 7 wins out of their 10 games. They have qualified for the playoffs. Two more teams to go through. Now, it's difficult for us to comment too much on who we think those teams will be because we don't get to see a lot of the W League. And what I definitely will do for the next show is get someone from the women's game, our friends down in Australia, onto the show to give us some insight and some views. But looking at it, what's your impression of what's going on down there at the moment?
Well, you know, the teams that were expected to qualify for the playoffs and have a chance for the grand final. Melbourne City, obviously, if you just look at that roster, I mean, you hate to play games on paper, but Melbourne City, that's a team that's going to be tough to beat. 36 goals for, 3 conceded. The goal differential of 33, that is, I'm going to have to use a word here that I don't often use. That is stupid, how that goal differential looks, because you don't see that whole lot. But Canberra United, obviously a team that knows how to get the job done when it comes to the postseason. And I'm going to be keeping an eye on, I'd like to say Adelaide. Now, this is a team that has, for the past few years, have not performed very well in the regular season, sometimes due to the fact that they just have very inexperienced squads. Some years that they're just competing against some teams that are far superior than them, but now in the mix at the moment, they're tied for fourth along with Newcastle and Brisbane, and have the superior goal differential against both of those teams with a couple of matches left. Be curious to see if Adelaide find themselves going into the last round of the season with a chance. Looking at their matches that they have going forward, their next round, which will be taking place very soon, will be against Perth, a team that is just been riddled with injuries. And then their final match of the season, which will take place in the week of the 15th through 17th of January, that will be Canberra home in Canberra with not much to play for. So, you know, you like their shot, you like their odds.
Yeah, and I think I can't really disagree with you, to be honest. I know that the league has been arguably more competitive this year. I know Melbourne City have run away with it. I know Canberra are comfortably in second, but teams have been taking points off of each other. I mean, you look at teams that have really, really struggled in the last couple of years have certainly made more of an impact this year. Melbourne Victory, we're not used to seeing near the bottom of the league. They've struggled this year. I know that there was quite a funny tweet that Keelan Winters sent out from her account on Twitter when her club Western Sydney Wanderers came up against Melbourne City, because obviously that was Keelan against her midfield partners for the Seattle Reign, Kim Little and Jess Fishlock. I think Melbourne ran out 4-0 winners in that game, and she tweeted out that playing with those two was a dream and playing against them was an absolute nightmare. So it's been good for, I guess, players to, you know, to come up against players that they're used to playing with sometimes. Okay, so we'll get the women's game on the next episode to discuss the state of play and their views on the teams and the players that have stood out this season. But I think that'll round up the W League, JJ. Much to look forward to in the back end of the season in that league. But when we come back, we will have a discussion about some of the prospects in the NWSL draft.
Women's Soccer Zone. Listen to the show on Audioboom or download via iTunes. Just search for Women's Soccer Zone.
Okay, welcome back. JJ, you and I will be in Baltimore this time next week to oversee the NWSL draft. Now, we're not going to go into too much detail because you have a nice piece for Our Game magazine coming out with your predictions on who may go where or who will get picked in what position. So rather than going through that work player by player, let's pick out some highlights. I guess my question would be, who are the players that you think are going to be the standouts within that draft?
Well, you know, it's interesting because at the time of recording, Kieran, we don't have a full list of players who are declaring themselves eligible for the draft. For those who are kind of curious and wondering what I'm meaning by that, is players, you just don't have a selection of, say, every collegiate senior that graduated. You have to say that you want to go and participate in the NWSL draft, and that's where we'll get our list. So a lot of these players are just trying to have an idea on, you know, and we have a good idea that they're going to be participating in the draft. And you know, you start with defenders. Emily Sonnet, who's with the United States national team out of University of Virginia, is one of them. Carrie Recaro, former youth international defender, will be available, or should be available. You know, for people in England, definitely Rachel Daly. We're hearing word that she should be declaring herself eligible and had a fine career at St. John's University. And there are a couple other dark horses as well that I think that could make a difference.
Who are those dark horses?
Well, you know, one of them I think that could make a real impact if she does declare eligible for the draft, a player called Nicole Waters, a player from Canada that went to Dayton out in the state of Ohio. 54 career assists in her 4 years out at that school this past year, coming off of 17 assists, and as a player that could go box to box, can be, you know, very attack minded as well, knows how to find feet of the forwards, and that's someone that I think could be, you know, a real standout player. And also there's a big question mark that I have about Raquel Rodriguez, who is the Costa Rican international, played with Penn State and led them to a national championship last month. And, you know, we're not sure if she's going to be playing in the NWSL, and I know it kind of sounds a little bit, you know, monotonous saying we're not sure, but, you know, to be fair, we won't know until, you know, next week's time. But, you know, if she's another player that declares eligible, I think she's going to be a great addition to the league. So technical, great touch, knows how to pick her head up and find a good ball. And, you know, if she's a player that could go, and I think she could be a player that goes, she'll be a top three pick, no doubt about it.
Do, in your view, I know it sounds like an obvious question, but maybe you can give some reasoning why. International players, we know in the NWSL, are at a premium because there are only so many spots available. For players like Raquel Rodriguez from Costa Rica, for players like Rachel Daly and Leah Galton from England, and for players like Janine Becky, for example, who is Canadian, how much are their chances of being drafted limited because of the number of international spots that are available in the league?
It is limited. It also depends on what teams are willing to go out and use a spot, because, you know, the one thing that is a little bit of a misconception is, you know, you could go ahead and draft a player, that by no means means that they're going to be on the team that they're drafted with at the start of the season. They still have to earn their way with a contract, they have to get themselves onto the team, and obviously with the limited roster space of 20 contracted players, you know, that doesn't mean that there are going to be available player, you know, many available spots per team. So it limits in some ways, but also you have some teams that don't have a whole lot of international players, and they might go out and say, hey, this might be the year that we're going to go out and draft a Rachel Daly or a Leah Galton or Janine Becky, for example. So it makes the game a little bit more interesting and difficult at the same time. But, you know, I think if international players want to have a go, they go and put themselves eligible. If they don't get drafted, then they go perhaps to, you know, individual team tryouts. So it isn't the end of the world if you don't get drafted, or if you're an international status and you don't get selected. You still can earn your way onto the team with other avenues outside of a draft.
Well, it'll be interesting. We won't talk too much about it because we're going to be recording from the NWSL draft next week. But I guess when we look at the class of last year, we can see that if the teams get it right, they can get some real gems in their hand, can't they? Or they can get some real gems that become a part of that squad. I mean, 5 of the 9 that were picked in the first round last year have gone on to receive US Women's National Team calls. So you get it right, and actually you might have an international on your hands, and actually the 4 that didn't get picked for the US Women's National Team, still very influential for their clubs as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look again at players like Morgan Bryan from last year with the draft. You know, she had such a big influence on the U.S. team. You know, really grew as that World Cup tournament went on, and, you know, really getting herself into the realm of being a professional at this game. And then, you know, outside of that, you look at, you know, the preparations for the U.S. and some of what they've been going through adding into the pool. You have players like Sam Mewis, Steph McCaffrey, who've, you know, gotten themselves in a good position as well, Jalene Hinkle, and Danny Cole Perico, who have started to make a name for themselves. And, you know, that was just from one round of last year's NWSL draft. And there's always that potential for, you know, players who prove themselves at the professional game to get a look at the international level. And that's what you saw out of last year. And you never know, you might see something out of it this year, and also potentially, you know, not only for the US team, but for internationals as well.
And even the four players that weren't selected for the US women's national team, they had a big influence on their club teams, and even further down the draft, going into the second and even the third round. But I think we'll leave it there, mate. Obviously in Baltimore next week, so we will bring some updates from the NWSL draft. Really looking forward to that. And when we come back after this short break, we'll bring our interview with Stacey Copeland. So I'm doing things a little bit differently on this episode of Women's Soccer Zone. I am pleased to be joined by English boxer Stacey Copeland, who actually started out as a footballer before taking to the ring. So Stacey, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. So I want to talk a little bit about your boxing, but I want to begin by talking about your football career, because you played to a decent standard. You played at England under 18 level. You played for Doncaster Rovers Bells. You won some medals along the way. I guess I'd start off by saying, where did your interest in football first come from? Because you do come from a boxing family that we'll talk about shortly.
Yeah, it's a strange one, really, because the boxing is quite obvious, if you like, the fact that my dad was a professional and my granddad was a boxer and runs our boxing gym. So it's very much in my family. However, football, nobody really played. I had an uncle who was a goalie, you know, sort of, you know, youth level and stuff, but nobody who advanced past that, really. There was no particular keen interest in it. You know, supporters of local teams and so on, but nobody who played with any real passion or success. So I don't really know where, you know, in terms of influence, where that came from. It was just, I don't really know. It was when I was at school, in the playground, I was never really interested in doing hopscotch and, you know, skipping and all of that, which the girls tended to do. I just was drawn towards the footy pitch with all the lads, and there used to be me, loads and loads of lads. And, you know, I just used to join in with the football at playtime and lunchtime, and then that led to me being asked to join the, you know, the school team. So pretty much probably the same as how a lot of girls got into it as youngsters, you know, at school with your mates. But back then there weren't any other girls doing it, really, because that was in the 80s.
How responsive were the boys that you played football with? We've heard stories from the likes of Rachel Yankee, who unbelievably had to pretend to be a boy to be accepted and to play with other lads. And we've heard about Kelly Smith, who would play in boys' teams, and the parents were the ones that were against her being on the field. How did the boys and those around you respond to you playing?
I had very similar experiences. I think what part of the problem was, looking back, was that the FA didn't sort of take ownership of girls and women's football until, I think it was round about 1993, which was, you know, prior to when I was sort of getting involved at school. So the at the time, you weren't allowed as such to mix, you know, boys and girls teams together, but then there weren't really hardly any girls teams, so effectively you couldn't really play, you know, in a proper competitive league, really. So I did exactly the same thing. I had a short haircut as a kid, and used to try and pretend to be a boy, if you like, and in order to play on the football team. And I do have one picture of myself with the school team, and you can't really tell if I was a boy or a girl, you know, when you're that young, you know, unless you've got long hair, you can't really tell, can you? So that's basically what I did. I don't remember any major resistance from the boys. I do remember getting a few sort of funny looks, you know, in the playground and so on, in primary school. However, I didn't really come across any resistance to it in a major way until secondary school, and that's when I kind of became most aware that what I was doing was different, because I had, you know, joint interests in football and boxing from an early age, which to me was completely normal. But as I got to secondary age, then I became aware that it was, you know, abnormal to everybody else.
And in the meantime, we'll talk about it in a bit, your dad, as you mentioned, was a professional boxer. You're having to go home and tell him about the fact that you're having to cut your hair short to be accepted in the boys' team. Was there ever any time where he said, give it up, come and do the boxing, and we'll get you, you know, taught up in that sport?
Well, as it happens, I was going boxing three nights a week to my granddad's gym, where my dad and my granddad and so on were coaching me, but women's boxing was even later in terms of, you know, equality, because it wasn't until 1997 that it was even legal for women to compete in this country. Of course, they did, but illegally, if you like, unlicensed shows and so on the underground boxing scene. But in terms of being legally sanctioned, it wasn't until 1997. So it wasn't even an option for me to compete at all as a female in this country in boxing. Gradually, as I got to sort of the age of 10 or 11, there was starting to be loads and loads of you know, girls' teams. And once the FA got involved, you know, properly, and had a plan and, you know, some sort of scheme for properly, you know, a vision for the women's game, then everything took off and it rapidly, you know, progressed from there, as we know.
I mean, incredible barriers, isn't it, to think that women's boxing was illegal, women's football, lots of youngsters had to, you know, pretend to be boys or had, you know, a lot of opposition to them being involved. For a young girl, that must be very demoralising, and you must be thinking, why should I bother? I might as well not bother. Might as well not bother participating in sport.
Well, actually, as a young girl, sadly, I didn't question, because it was just how it was. I didn't really question the fact that, you know, I was there training three nights a week with all the boys, because, again, I was the only girl in the boxing gym. I absolutely loved the sport just as I did with football, and yet the same opportunities just weren't there. And I didn't question it because it's all I'd known. And now I have the opportunity, as I'm sure the other girls do in other sports, to go into schools and talk to young people. And that's one of the things that I try and encourage them to do, is to question the way that things are, because just because it's the way it's always been doesn't mean it's right. And it's something we have to question and then, you know, challenge it and be, hopefully be part of the change. Because I don't remember questioning it at all as a young girl. It wasn't until I got older that I've started to think to myself, this isn't really fair. You know, like, and I think, you know, laws and rules come in, don't they? Like, for example, it was made legal for females to be involved and compete in boxing in this country. But the, you know, hearts and minds of the people and the culture and the ethos takes a lot longer to change. For example, 97, it was made equal in terms of the law changing for women, but it wasn't really until the Olympics in 2012 that people started to say, do you know what, these female boxers are good and they should have the opportunity. And, you know, for a lot of people, it wasn't until the World Cup this year in football till they started to say, those, you know, those women deserve respect, that they're, you know, they're good, they're really good. Of course, the rest of us have known that the England team have been fantastic for a very long time, but that's how long it takes for people to start to change the view.
You persevered with the football, and it would be fair to say you had a fairly decent career. You played for Doncaster Rovers Bells, you represented England under 18 level, you won a few caps. You got a scholarship and played out in the United States in the college system. And then once you graduated, you had a stint out in Sweden playing for Vasslunds, who I believe are a semi-professional team, or certainly were at the time. How do you look back at your football career? Fondly?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, when it comes to football and boxing for that matter, I achieved more than I ever would have imagined possible, but perhaps not as much as I could have done if I'd have believed in myself more at different times. But, you know, you're only capable of doing what you're doing, you know, each competition and each season and so on, and you gain that experience and get better as you go on. But, yeah, I'm absolutely, you know, overwhelmed and grateful for the opportunities that I've given and the people that helped me, you know, be ready and create those opportunities for me, absolutely.
When you're participating in a sport like boxing, I know you have a team of people around you, fitness coaches, trainers, all those sorts of people. Are there ever any times where you miss the camaraderie that comes with being in a football team and a team environment?
Sometimes, yeah. Although I don't think about it that often, because I think you're that focused on, you know, developing and progressing and so on, that it's not something you tend to dwell on that much. But yeah, sometimes I think I've missed the fact that when you're in a team, it's nice to have that one common goal that you're all aiming towards. However, I do really feel that, boxing is a team effort because, as you say, you've got lots and lots of people around you who are helping you reach that goal. And you reaching that goal is success for them as well. They do feel part of that journey because they've been such a huge part of it along the way. So, you know, right up until the point when you get in the ring, it's taken a lot of people to help get you to where you're at. And even then, sort of encouraging and shouting advice during the fight, and obviously, you know, it's vital what advice they give you in the corner in those minutes in between rounds. So I very much feel like I'm part of a team. And then once you get to the international level and you go away as an England or GB boxer, then you're representing your country and you very much feel part of a team then, absolutely. So I think I still get that team element anyway.
What are the kind of stand-up memories from your time with Doncaster Rovers Bells? Myself and Jen O'Neill, who runs She Kicks magazine, we had an event in Doncaster about a month ago with Karen Walker, Jill Coulthard and Sue Smith.
Oh, brilliant, yeah.
What's your recollection of your time at Donny?
My first memory was because I'd always wanted to play for Donny Bells because as a young girl, I had no idea whatsoever that an England team existed, that there was, you know, anything outside my backyard and my school playground. Because then, I mean, even now, you know, we've still got a long way to go with recognising, you know, women in sport. But back then, there was nothing. However, every now and then, there'd be little clips of Donny Bells in the FA Cup, and it just seemed to always be them. As I was growing up, we're in the FA Cup, you know, against, you know, whoever the opponent might have been, Millwall or whoever it was. But Donny Bells always seemed to be there. And because they were the only team that I had any awareness of until the USA came on the scene in a big way in the World Cup. They were the team that I always sort of looked up to, and that was my dream, really. So when I very first went to sort of play for them, I went to a training session. It was Julie Chipchase, who was the manager at the time, and I kind of turned up and went into the changing room, and I just remember being completely, you know, awestruck by everybody who was in there, you know, one of which was Karen Walker, of course, and Jill Coulthard, and, you know, all the great players that they had, Claire Utley, and just, I mean, you name it, every single player was just a superstar to me. And I just remember sitting there thinking, oh my God, like, this is really happening. And that's my first memory of just being a sort of 17-year-old, 18, whatever I was, just thinking, wow, this is amazing.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you say you saw those players and those teams on in the FA Cup final. You got to play in one yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think as any kid who loves football, that's one of the things, obviously, you dream about. It never loses its magic, does it, whether you're male or female? You know, whether you're a fan or an actual player or both, it's something you always kind of dream about. So they're great memories because I think, I'm sure, you know, all clubs, and I've played for various clubs. I started out in the Premier League at Carmi Rovers, and, you know, I think any club you're with, generally, they tend to have a great atmosphere. But in particular at Donny Bells, there's something special about Yorkshire people, and, you know, the support around us and the people that are involved with the club were just absolutely fantastic. And I remember every week, you know, whether it was going for training or games, just such a really good community and almost family-like atmosphere at the club. And I just loved every minute there. And I had a spell away whilst I was having, you know, injuries and stuff like that, and went back, and John Buckley was manager by then, and we'd lost a lot of players by then, you know, because other teams got a little bit of money, you know, financial incentives for players and so on. So it's a little bit different when I returned, but still that atmosphere was there and that real community sense, and it was just a great club to play for. I loved it.
Well, injury kind of curtailed your career a little bit early, but you didn't become a couch potato. You followed your other passion, which is, of course, boxing, and at the age of 29 you made the crossover. You've had a decent career boxing wise so far as well, an ABA champion, a nations champion, a European silver medalist. What elements of your football skills and your football characteristics have crossed over into the boxing ring?
I think the only physical aspect would be that as an older athlete, because I'd always done boxing in the closed season. I'd always carried on with boxing. I just hadn't competed. That was obviously the decision I made at 29, because football was my priority for many years. So I think the fact that I'd always trained and always been, you know, a top-level athlete, if you like, my body was well-conditioned for any sport, really. So I think, you know, that was it wasn't like I was coming to a sport brand new at 29. I'd always done sport, so my body was used to training. Obviously, I had to adapt to, you know, losing a lot of weight because boxing's a weight-based sport, and also adapting to the type of training that I was doing. I mean, I think now if I played a 90-minute game of football or even 10 minutes, I'd struggle to walk for a few days because it's so very different. So I had to adapt physically, but I think that, you know, that foundation of that physicality was there, obviously, from a previous sport. But I think mostly what carried over for me was the mental approach, the teamwork aspect, determination, sort of being disciplined, setting goals and all of that, which I'd, you know, drawn from football, definitely applied directly to boxing.
Do you ever miss it? Ever miss the football pitch?
Not now. I did do at first. And every now and again, I can, you know, sort of... You know, I work in a school, and sometimes the kids are having a bit of a kickabout and stuff, and, you know, I'll muck in with them every now and then, and you do kind of miss it, because I think what's nice is that you know, if you've loved a sport all your life, you never quite lose that special feeling you had as a kid, where, you know, even if it was just you and a football and a wall, just kicking it against it over and over and over again, doing keep-ups, trying new little tricks, imagining that you're in the FA Cup final scoring a goal, you know what I mean? Just those kind of things. You never quite lose that, I don't think. It's always got that little bit of a magic, I think. So, yeah, I enjoy that, but I don't miss it enough to ever play again, because it's kind of closed that door, and I just love the boxing now.
Well, we'll finish off, final question, about the state of women's boxing. We know about the challenges that footballers have had over the years. You've talked about some of the challenges that female boxers have had, most notably especially when it was illegal. You've now got names out there like yourself, like Nicola Adams, like Ireland's Katie Taylor, who are really raising the profile. You've also got maybe former female boxers, people like Holly Holm, who's now in the UFC, who's a former boxer. Does it feel like, you know, it's the future is bright for women's boxing, that you are being given the platform that you now deserve, and it's being recognised in the right way?
Yeah, I think it's getting there. For me, watching the World Cup, the football Women's World Cup this year, was quite emotional at times, because although I've not felt a major connection to football for some years, obviously whilst I've been focused on boxing, it's 5 years since I've played football now, it's still very much a part of who I am, and you know, it was my entire life for so many years. You know, I woke up thinking about football, I went to bed thinking, you know, it was everything. And I felt quite emotional watching the girls, for the fact that, you know, I've been a little part of that journey, like they've been a huge part of it, obviously, but all of us who've played women's football at some point have been part of that journey. And it did feel quite emotional to finally see sort of the women's team succeed on that scale, and to hear people saying, wow, these girls are fantastic, look how good they are. And like I say, we've known that for a long time, but it was so fantastic to see them getting the recognition that they deserve. And of course, a lot of the girls in the team, you know, were in the under-18s team with me and around about at that time in the Premier League, and they've finally got that recognition. So it's fantastic to see. And I do think, having seen it happen in football, that it will happen in boxing. One of the biggest problems that we face, other than, you know, people's perceptions of women, particularly in a combat sport, is the fact that the Olympics is still very unequal, in the fact that there are 3 weight categories for women and 10 for men. So that's obviously a huge, huge glass ceiling. Me, myself, I'm not an Olympic weight, so that means I can't be a full-time athlete. I can't have the, you know, the vision and the goal of the pinnacle of your career as an amateur boxer of going to the Olympics. It's not even an option, which is, you know, really frustrating in one way. On the other hand, I'm very grateful that, you know, England and GB provide non-Olympic weights the opportunity to go to the Europeans and the World Championships, which are coming up again next year. But yeah, I think when we get equality in terms of the weight classes in the Olympics, which will be after my time, it'll be, you know, a huge, huge difference, and we'll then be on a more level playing field. I do think we'll get there. Progress is slow, as it always is, but it's my job as an older athlete to be part of, you know, being as positive a role model as I can for the young girls coming through, representing the sport in as positive a way as I can, so that, you know, long term, it helps with that progress.
Well, there's a big parallel there, isn't there? Because obviously the England women's team won't be participating in the Olympics either because of Team GB and the issues that they face. But I really do wish you well, Stacey, with the Euros World Championships next year. I'm sure they will be fascinating, and we'll definitely keep tabs on how you're getting on. And despite the fact that you've left the football pitch and entered the ring, we'll get you back on and then you can tell us on how you're getting on.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you very much.
Women's Soccer Zone. It's all about the players.
So that was Stacey Copeland, really insightful, and big thanks to her. And that rounds up this episode of Women's Soccer Zone. Unfortunately, I've lost JJ due to internet problems, so I've lost him on Skype. But obviously, big thanks to him once again for helping me record this show. Of course, a massive thanks to Andy Spence and to Stacey Copeland for coming on. And a big thanks to you once again tuning in. We're in our third year. We're about to celebrate our three-year anniversary for Women's Soccer Zone. So thank you very much for tuning in. If you wish to contact us, you can do so on Twitter on @WosoZone. Email us on wosozone@gmail.com, and don't forget that the show can be listened to on iTunes or at audioboom.com/wosozone. So until the next time, we'll be bringing you the next show from Baltimore. So until then, take care and bye bye.